This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today our show begins with a discussion with one of our favorite philosophers. He is our favorite philosopher, let's just say that. Jack Russell Weinstein, he's the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. And you'll hear that this Sunday at 5 Central on Prairie Public Presents on our radio network. And Jack, you have a very intriguing subject this week. Tell our listeners what it is.
Well, we are looking at police ethics, and in particular, the limits of police authority insofar as they represent the government. So what can the police do? How far can they go? And how much do they have the right to sort of invade our lives?
And you picked Luke William Hunt, an assistant professor of criminal justice at Radford University, to have this discussion with. Why did you pick him?
Well, he has a PhD in philosophy. He also is a former FBI agent. And so he brings real experience to the discussion. And he just wrote a book with a really sort of technical name called The Retrieval of Liberalism in Policing. But what that actually means is, how do we preserve individual rights in the face of police power? And so it's not the kind of discussion that is limited to, should a police officer have done this, should a police officer have done that, but rather law enforcement in general in the United States. How does it stay effective and yet keep people free?
And what was the issue or issues that jumped out at you when you considered this topic and this fellow to talk to about it?
Well, actually, the thing that intrigued me the most is the way that his discussion about police asks us what it means to be a person in a free society. In philosophy, person is a technical term. It means someone who is free, who is an agent responsible for his or her own actions, and who has to be respected with a certain kind of dignity. And he's very interested in asking, if in a free society, persons or people are regarded as free agents who are deemed respect, then how do the police justify what they do? And how far can a police officer go, or the FBI or someone else go, in order to solve a crime, protect a person, punish someone, etc.? It's this question of how the police relate to what we think a person is that is most intriguing to me.
And one of the more interesting aspects of this is the use of informants as, you know, helping the police. So before we get into that, let's just have this general description of how you believe philosophy relates to law.
Philosophy and law are incredibly closely intertwined. One of the easiest ways to think about it is that philosophy tends to deal with ideals, perfect situations, and law tends to deal with imperfect situations because, of course, in a perfect world, no one would break the law, no one would be a criminal, no one would steal your stuff. But philosophy also deals with non-ideal stuff and yet doesn't know how to apply it. And so the law is really the application of philosophy. We have philosophers in the government. They're called the justices of the Supreme Court. Their job is to take the Constitution and be philosophers to ask, how do the overall principles of our society apply to everyday life, and how do the agents of the government, the police, the FBI, etc., enforce those laws? So one easy way of thinking about it is that philosophy is the idea and law is the application of the idea.
Well, let's talk about one of those tools used in the application of the idea, the criminal informant. In movies and novels, this informant is a common character. How has that affected our opinion about this practice, do you think, before we get specific?
I think the movies romanticize informants in a way that probably is inaccurate. I was thinking of Goodfellas. I was thinking of Donnie Brasco. I was thinking of all of the mafia movies where you get someone who gets completely immersed in culture and then faces this moral dilemma. Do they tell? Do they not tell? And the first thing that I learned from the book, which was a real surprise to me, was we probably shouldn't think of informants any different than bugs. And what I mean by that is not the insect, but the little microphones that we hide. We don't think about those in the same way. You put a microphone under a lamp in the movies, or you sort of intercept communications, and it's technology. An informant is basically the same thing. It's just a human form of that technology. And so we tend to think of the rules for informants as different than the rules for microphones, but they probably ought to be similar because the informant is there listening and reporting in just the same way. And so that was the first surprise, that we think of informants as people, but they also play the role of technology.
Yet people get killed, and the microphone might just get pulled out of the wall.
That's absolutely right, and that's the whole other side of it. Informants seem like they have choices, but they often don't. And so the police come and say, we're going to arrest you for having marijuana unless you inform on your friends, or unless you go to this gang site, or unless you buy marijuana for us and let us listen. And first of all, the person doesn't necessarily have a choice, right? Maybe they got into it by their own volition. Maybe it was a trap that they set for themselves, but they still don't have a choice. And then they're on their own. And so we know of instances here in Fargo. We know of national instances where young college students get sucked into being informants and their lives are at risk, and sometimes they're killed. And is there any justification for asking someone who is already sort of a focus of the criminal justice system to put their life on the line? That is a troubling situation and one he faces head on.
Yes, it is sobering. I mean, I read the abstract of Luke Hunt's book, The Retrieval of Liberalism in Policing, and one of the cases he covers is the tragic case study involving the police's use of Rachel Hoffman, who was a college senior when she was first incriminated regarding her use and sale of marijuana. She ends up dead after willing to be a police informant. And that reminded us, me, of this North Dakota State College of Science student who about 4 years ago, was found dead. He was also accused of felony possession of marijuana and was acting as a police informant. And there's still no resolution to that crime.
One of the things that we forget, because we're so used to law and order dramas and movies, and we have our politics about who's guilty of what and who should be punished for what, is that when a defendant goes to court, it's one person, maybe a couple people, against the entire government. They walk into this court, and it's this massive room with police officers and judges and recorders and journalists and audiences, and they stand alone, and they don't have a lot of power. And so along comes someone who says, you're going to go to prison for 20 years or you're going to help us. I don't know what choice means in that circumstance. And that brings us back to this question of what it means to do this in a free society. Freedom means the ability to choose, but it's not so simple to say every person is equally free and every person has an equal choice. If you are in the criminal justice system, and you're facing all of these consequences, even if you're innocent, it's not quite the same thing as saying you have a choice to participate in the same way that, say, someone walking down the street has a choice to pick up a $10 bill or to throw a can in the recycling bin. Choice is incredibly complicated in philosophy, and in fact, choice is incredibly complicated in the law. And so once we start looking at these questions in terms of what it means to be a person, we can ask, and this is going to sound a little weird, but we can ask, is a criminal defendant a person? And what I mean by that is, does a criminal defendant have the same kind of freedom and agency as everyone else does? And if he or she doesn't, is it just, is it fair, is it moral to put them in a position where their way out is to be an informant? It might not be.
Yes, it's a troubling position to be in. I was just listening to the monitor in my head when I referred to that college student in Wahpeton who was found dead, and the assumption I was making was it was a criminal act. Well, maybe it was, you know, self-inflicted. We don't know yet, but this person was put in a circumstance which resulted in death.
And we know very little about the circumstance. We know very little about the people he was asked to inform on. We know very little about what kind of backup the student had. We also, in all honesty, don't know anything about the intelligence of the student, the experience of the student, right? We have students who come from very rural backgrounds who are now in what they may consider a bigger city with people who they've never had interactions with when they've grew up with people who they've known their entire life. Do they have good judgment in that social situation? That's a conversation that actually I don't recall coming up at all in the discussion. To what extent was this young man experienced enough and sophisticated enough to know how to make good and bad judgments as an informant. He clearly wasn't sophisticated enough to know how to make good or bad judgments and not get caught, right, for whatever crime he allegedly did. And so, I don't know, that's a lot of burden to place on anybody, especially a college kid.
Well, let's get to the ethics of this, I guess. If law enforcement instructs an informant to break the law, isn't that unethical, possibly immoral? Is the greater good in this case something an enforcement agency should be allowed to decide?
That's a really interesting and important question. Let's take a very simple version of it first. It's illegal to cross against the red light, right? Jaywalking. We don't think about it much these days, but it's illegal. So a police officer is chasing a suspect and the suspect crosses the street. Do you say, well, okay, the police officer's allowed to jaywalk? I think you would. The suspect is now driving very quickly, 85, 90 miles an hour. Do we say that the police officer can break the law to speed, right? This is a little harder because we know that there are some police officers that are instructed there are some departments where they don't do high-speed chases because it's incredibly dangerous and you can kill innocent people. Now, you just keep escalating that to the question of, should you bug someone illegally? Should you entrap someone? There's a really interesting case in the book where he talks about police officers posing as drunk people with money hanging out of their wallets in Las Vegas and who they target to try to entrap and who they target not to entrap. And so you keep escalating until you get to this question, how far can a police officer go? And one answer is maybe the police officer can't break any law at all. Or maybe the police officer has to use his or her discretion. And that's the other element of breaking the law, which is that one of the things we trust in a police officer is to make good judgments. We give police officers a lot of discretion. We give FBI agents a lot of discretion to make these decisions. Is it fair that they as individuals make the decisions, or should the system as a whole make the decision? Should there be policies, procedures? These are tough questions. And if you have an informant who is selling marijuana or buying marijuana, that is, at least in North Dakota currently, against the law, and you're telling someone, break the law for the greater good. It's just not that simple.
So the police officer is trained. The police officer has discretion. The informant is an informant.
Think about all of the training that a police officer goes through in order to be a police officer. But there's also something else going on, and it's a thing he says early on in the book that sounds incredibly boring but really opened a lot of doors for me. He said police officers have two different roles. One is to enforce the law and to keep people safe, etc., engage in criminal investigations, that sort of thing. But the other is to navigate the massive legal bureaucracy of the criminal law. And that really made me stop and think because, of course, what a police officer, what an FBI agent, what a law enforcement officer has to do is know the rules and know how to get through them in an effective way. They've had massive training. They have supervisors. They have regular discussions at work about it. And the informant has none of this. So the informant is becoming a law enforcement officer, but being an officer without any training and without any expertise. And that's problematic as well.
Has Luke Hunt's research about this topic in his book changed your opinion or altered your opinion about this practice?
You know, I don't know that it's changed my opinion. It certainly made me think that it's more complicated than I had originally thought. I haven't talked to him yet, and so I'll be doing that on Sunday. So I always learn stuff, and I always sort of adjust my position during the conversations. But as a political philosopher, what this really helped me see is that there are connections to political philosophy that I had never anticipated before, that I had never thought of. And so it made me really, I guess, more aware of the complexity of the difficulties, and it made it much more interesting. And I guess that's the bottom line, and that's what I try to do with Why Radio all the time, right, is I find it infinitely more interesting than I did when I started the book, and that's super exciting.
Well, one question I'd be interested in hearing him answer is, should law enforcement be required to present proposed arrangements with informants for judicial approval like they do have to for electronic surveillance?
I think that's a great question, and I'll definitely have to ask him that, because certainly that slows things down a bit, but also it means that there is a third party. There's a check and balance. There's oversight, and oversight in a free society is an absolute necessity. We get in trouble when we are lone wolves. We get in trouble when we don't have people looking out for us, right? Oversight isn't just about punishing people. Oversight is about helping us make good decisions. This is why when we have difficult life decisions, we ask our friends what they think, right? Because we get so wrapped up in our heads, or we get so wrapped up in urgency, that we sometimes make bad decisions. And so judicial approval might help protect the informant, it might help protect the law enforcement, and it might help make everyone be a little more rational about their decision making.
Well, Jack, this brings up another issue, because occasionally we hear about rogue police officers or rogue departments even, who might use informants or surveillance to gather evidence in a wrong way, and then use the evidence they've gathered to get the authority to do it the right way.
This is also a question about personhood and a question about rights. So you often hear of people getting off on a technicality, right? And that's often suggested as a negative thing. But what that usually means is that the criminal justice system did something wrong. The police officer broke a law that he or she wasn't allowed to. The FBI crossed boundaries that they weren't permitted to. And so when you say someone got off on a technicality, what you really mean is these people's rights were violated, and rights are the most important thing in a free society. So if we believe that the United States should support individual rights, if we think that our personhood, our agency, who we are as individuals is the most important thing in the United States, if we believe in liberty, in political liberty, then anytime we say someone got off on a technicality, what we're really saying is that we value democracy and we value individual rights enough that it's more important than, say, truth, right? Rights are more important than truth, which is why, of course, we let different religions exist in our society. One of those religions may be true, which means that the others are not true. But they're all permitted to be here because rights are more important than truth in a free society. And if the police go someplace they're not supposed to, if the police use informants or bugs or something like that in a way that violates someone's rights, you're not allowed to use that in the criminal court.
Well, this is the 21st century, and we have remarkable reliance on electronic communications and record keeping. And that invariably would put us at risk for police or state surveillance if that were, you know, decided on against us. So should this possibility, and for that matter likelihood, spur us to require our representative governments to enact additional protection?
I think that's without question. Think for a second about how you click the iTunes terms of agreement, and how many times you say, I agree on the computer with a new program or a new site. You don't read it. I don't read it. And even if we did read it, we probably wouldn't understand it because we're not lawyers. So there's all of these things that we agree to, but that may in fact be illegal or unconstitutional. There's this doctrine called unconscionability, which means you can't enforce a contract that's illegal. You can't say, I agree to give my children up to adoption if you give me $10,000, right? It's illegal. And so the more laws there are governing surveillance, the more laws there are governing our computer life, the more restricted people will be. And so then the next question becomes, suppose Apple, or let's say Facebook, because you have Facebook Messenger, suppose Facebook Messenger says in the terms of agreement, we agree to turn over all text to the police upon request. Well, that doesn't quite mesh with the Fourth Amendment, the illegal search and seizure. You need a search warrant. You need justification. But at the same time, when people first started talking about search warrants, it was during Prohibition. And the people who were selling illegal alcohol said, you are not allowed to listen to my conversations. That's a violation of privacy. The court at first agreed, and then it didn't agree, and then it did agree. And it's the same sort of thing. When they invented microphone, we had to create new laws. Now that we have all this other kind of technology, they have to create new laws.
Well, I was reminded that the Fourth Amendment is not a guarantee against all searches and seizures. It is a guarantee that those will only be deemed unreasonable under the law if they're illegal. But, of course, that's a value judgment. That's a philosophical application to the law.
That's absolutely right. I mean, what the Fourth Amendment tells us is that we are all entitled to due process, right? That you have this judicial review. You have these other options that allow us to say, this kind of surveillance is okay. This kind of surveillance is not okay. This kind of search and seizure is okay. This kind of search and seizure is not okay. There is ambiguity in the law, and there has to be, because no law can predict every single situation. No law can predict every single application. And so you have to have the philosophers, you have to have the judges, you have to have the experts make the best determination they can, and then you have other people check up on them.
Well, this will be the discussion that Jack Russell Weinstein will have with Luke Hunt, the assistant professor of criminal justice at Radford University, when Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, airs on Prairie Public Presents Sunday at 5 Central. Jack, thanks for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure.
Coming up, Chuck Lura looks to the sky in a natural North Dakota essay.
I'm going to have to sneak out of the house, all right? We're going to take your dad's car, we're going to go to prom, and hopefully you drop me off early. I'm going to sneak back into the house, and if my dad catches me and kills me, well, YOLO, you know what I mean? You live once. What an amazing way to go out, right?
Join us for more True Stories Told Live, The Prom, Secrets, The Winding Road to Citizenship, and more. Next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Former professor Chuck Lura is a regular contributor to our show with his natural North Dakota essays. You can find him anytime on our website, too, at prairiepublic.org. Just select the radio tab and pull down the list of our podcasts. Today, Chuck looks up at the heavens to talk about the upcoming Geminid meteor shower.
It's time to look for the stars. Falling stars, that is. The Geminids meteor shower, which many consider the best meteor shower of the year, has already started. It started on the 7th and will run to the 17th. The peak viewing period will come on the evening hours of Thursday, December 13th, and early morning of the 14th. If the sky is clear during the show, it could be quite impressive, in part because we'll have a first quarter moon during the peak viewing period. The Geminids' reputation as the best meteor shower is based on the expected number of meteors visible each year. Estimates put the number at perhaps 120 per hour during the peak viewing period. Plus, the Geminids are also known for producing multicolored meteors. In addition to the Geminids, the Ursids meteor shower will be starting soon. The Ursids will run from December 7th to the 25th, with that peak viewing period coming on the evening of the 21st and early morning of the 22nd. Don't expect a great show, though. The Ursids generally produce only 5 to 10 meteors per hour, and this year the peak will coincide with a full moon. And as long as we're on the topic of meteor showers, another meteor shower will welcome us into the new year. From January 1st to the 5th, we'll be able to view the Quadrantids meteor shower. That could be a good one, with around 40 meteors per hour during the peak viewing period, which will occur on the evening of January 3rd and early morning of the 4th. A crescent moon should produce a minimal amount of interference. Remember that meteor showers are named after the constellations in which the meteors appear to originate. The Geminids, for example, will seem to have come out of the constellation Gemini. But the meteors may be observed in any area of the sky, so don't fret if you're not familiar with the constellations. If you miss these meteor showers, it's going to be a while until the next one. The next meteor shower won't occur until April 16th to the 25th, when the Lyrids meteor shower will take center stage. So you might want to consider taking a few minutes occasionally over the next few weeks to check for meteors. And of course, you could also use that time to learn some constellations, or just relax and enjoy the nighttime sky. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media looks at a new way to turn off certain genes in plant or animal cells. Root seller Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats, and Bill Thomas and I will look at what's happening this weekend. First, an update on the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The University of North Dakota wants to see if it can tap into a revolving loan fund set up for cities, counties, and other political subdivisions to help pay for roads, curbs, gutters, and similar improvements.
And of course, universities are not political subdivisions.
UND Vice President for Finance and Operations Jed Shivers says one potential option for UND to access those funds would be to have campuses treated as political subdivisions.
Because as universities, we really are carrying an infrastructure that is very city-like, and that would be true of all of the campuses across the system.
That would take legislative action. Shivers says the other proposal would have UND partner with the city. Grand Forks would have $15 million available to it, and he says one concept is to have the legislature expand the revolving loan fund so Grand Forks could leverage more of that money. He says UND could then partner with the city.
In some cases, there would be good synergies because right now it's you know, one stops, the other starts, depending upon where the border is in terms of where that work is done.
Shivers says the advantage in either option would be loans at 2% interest rates. A committee of the Board of Higher Education approved the concept of having campuses designated as political subdivisions. The full board will take it up later today. Grand Forks is the fifth best city in the nation for those who transition out of service and into civilian life. That's according to an analysis released by Navy Federal and Sperling's Best Places. The rankings are based on 11 different metrics. Bert Sperling is the founder and CEO of Sperling's Best Places.
Combined it with our quality of life, the cost of living, we looked at that as well. We looked at proximity to airports, social scene of an area as well. And we combined all those things together to find places that are affordable, have great quality of life, but plenty of resources for the transitioning veteran.
It's estimated that some 250,000 active duty military will transition out of service into civilian life in 2019. Brian Parker of Navy Federal Credit Union says states and local governments should learn to take advantage of outgoing military expertise.
Really what employers can do is take into account the characteristics that veterans already display from their time in service. Things like leadership skills, technical skills that they gained while they were serving, and really hone in on those to attract those service members.
As part of his state budget message, Governor Burgum this week proposed a 100% state income tax exemption on military retirement pay for members of armed forces, National Guard, and Reserve. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
President Trump plans to hold a second summit with Kim Jong-un. He says the North Korean leader hasn't lived up to promises he made in June. National Security Advisor John Bolton is optimistic.
If the North Koreans follow through on the commitments they made in Singapore, President Trump will deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. He opened a door for them. Now they have to walk through it.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A new technology called CRISPR allows scientists to turn off certain genes in a plant or animal. Its applications range from human medicine to plant breeding, but it's already mired in controversy. Recently, a Chinese scientist shocked the world with news that he had used the technology to alter human embryos. But there's a lot of research underway that's less high stakes. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer got a hands-on look at CRISPR.
In a lab at George Washington University, Arnaud Martin welcomes visitors with a video that shows a variety of butterflies with different colors and patterns on their wings. The CRISPR technology has helped Martin and his group identify a gene that affects wing appearance.
So what we do with CRISPR is nothing fancy. We don't do genome editing or, you know, detailed surgery. We just break genes.
That break switches off a precise gene function in a butterfly egg, ultimately changing how the wings look. The work is helping Martin's research group explore questions about evolution and development. On this day, they're letting a bunch of science writers try CRISPR. First, we get a small dish with a bunch of butterfly eggs. They're not microscopic. With a naked eye, you can see the tiny bluish dots. A close-up view through a microscope reveals they are, in fact, egg-shaped. We're instructed to nudge them gently with a glass rod until they stand on one end.
I have destroyed more eggs in interesting ways.
See, I did pretty well.
Yeah, you did.
When I finally get a few eggs in the right position, I take the dish to a different scope. This one is connected to an electric needle full of a reddish fluid. It contains Cas9, the protein tool that is the heart of CRISPR, and something called guide RNA. Grad student Vincent Figuerata explains what they do.
The guide RNA is the specific directional vector that will, you know, direct the Cas9 to the specific site in the DNA to cut there.
Figuerata says the DNA repairs itself around the cut, and then the egg continues otherwise normal development. There's no loud outcry against this CRISPR work with butterflies, but in November, a Chinese scientist announced he'd used CRISPR to alter DNA in human embryos. His goal? To protect a set of twins from AIDS. Colleagues decried his disregard for the peer review process and questioned the truth of his claim, but scientists and ethicists were left fearing the pending arrival of designer babies, genetically altered in utero to suit their parents' desire. No such high stakes for me here, but the same concept is at play. I struggle a bit getting the egg positioned.
My needle is not really in the same plane as my egg.
Research assistant Chris Day comes to my assistance.
Right now I have the needle touching the genes.
I tap the foot pedal and watch through the microscope as red goo oozes into the tiny egg. Martin uses this lab exercise in a class that also spends time discussing bioethics and appropriate uses for the technology.
What I'm telling the students is always to think about several levels of consequences.
Such as how a change will affect future generations of a species. If used responsibly, Martin says CRISPR could help solve many challenges, including in agriculture.
But if you want to feed the planet 9 billion people, I think we will benefit from accelerated domestication, from engineering crops, so they are less demanding in terms of resource, they're less vulnerable to pests, so less waste, better use of land, and so on.
CRISPR's use in plant breeding is a bit less controversial, as seeds can be made sterile, so genetic changes don't persist into offspring. Agriculture companies already have their eyes on it. Bayer Crop Science President Liam Condon was in Des Moines this fall.
It's a development that we're very excited about.
He says this time companies want the public to understand up front the value of a new technology.
One of the issues that we've always had with GMO technology is that the benefits are very clear for the grower, for the farmer, but they're not so clear for the consumer.
He's confident CRISPR's potential to remove food allergens or boost nutritional quality will appeal broadly. What worries him more is how different governments will approach regulating the technology.
It is important that there's kind of a consistent regulatory framework to ensure international trade with whatever is developed using CRISPR-Cas9.
GMOs taught the industry that important lesson after different approval timelines held up overseas deliveries of some U.S. crops. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that covers America's farm and food issues. Next on Main Street, Main Street Eats.
I was talking to my husband, and we had another thought this morning. You know, you usually at retirement age, you've raised your children, but grandchildren come along, and they retire you over again.
They do. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. English is a tricky lady. She's got aces up her sleeves.
Join us this week on Away with Words.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and joining us from our Bismarck studio, Sue Balcom, root cellar Sue, we call her, for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of us still have some Thanksgiving leftovers, and usually by the time you get this far out from Thanksgiving, it's like, oh yeah, there's 8 cranberries in the back of the fridge somewhere.
Hey, we just finished off our turkey. I made a turkey pot pie, and my biggest complaint was, we're out of cranberry sauce. We're out of cranberry sauce.
So let's talk about cranberries, because there's another holiday coming up. They get eaten in, around the Christmas holiday as well.
Absolutely, because I think, really, they're seasonal. They're a seasonal berry, and like most things, you'll find them more prevalent in the stores at a lower price right at the moment. And cranberries, of course, are native to North America, from what I believe the Native Americans used to harvest them. But I'm not sure what they would have sweetened them with, so we can assume safely that they probably added them to their pemmican when they were making food to last them all during the winter months.
They didn't have cans like we do.
Well, no, but really, Doug, you do know that cranberries aren't really shaped like a 303 can, okay? You know that, right?
With the ribs on it, yeah.
Right? With the ribs on it.
All comes out in one solid piece.
However, that stuff really is good for slicing and adding to turkey sandwiches. They used to make one at the Mandan drugstore, and you put cream cheese and turkey and cranberry sauce. It was delightful.
Actually, yeah, it does sound kind of good. But let's talk about the real deal here, the ones that we actually come to us as berries.
Right, and you can find them in the store. Of course, they're like about $1.99 a bag, and you'll need a whole bag to make just your basic cranberry relish, which there's a recipe on the back, and it's simply like a cup of sugar, a cup of water, and then you simmer those berries for about 5 minutes. Then let them completely cool on your counter so they don't have condensation issues when you put them in the refrigerator. But it's a kind of sweet, tart, very basic cranberry sauce, and I love cranberry sauce.
Do you eat it much outside of the holidays?
I do as much as I possibly can. However, the price of cranberries goes up considerably after December. And so if you watch and you can find them on sale, or if you're smart and you buy them and freeze them, then you can have cranberry sauce all year long.
And it's good for you, right?
Oh, superfood, one of those superfoods with high antioxidants. They're anti-inflammatory, they're antibacterial, and they grow in swamps according to the television commercials that I've seen.
Sue, you said boil them for about 5 minutes. They kind of open up, don't they?
They do. They bloom. But let me just correct you on one thing. There's a difference between boiling something and simmering something.
Thank you.
So you want to simmer them at a medium or medium-low temp, because when you boil things, they have a tendency to boil all the good flavor and the liquid out of them, and then you'll end up scorching them. Because remember, you did have to add sugar to them. But definitely simmer them. They kind of burst open. And they're just delicious compared to the canned stuff, which I know, my kids like them shaped like cans. But I think that's the big attraction, is the shape.
You mentioned by stocking up this time of year and then freezing them. Do you want to do anything before you freeze them?
Actually, I just buy the bags and toss them in my
freezer.
Okay. And I know that you are supposed to rinse them once you open them up, but I would not do that before freezing. Because like most of the berries that you freeze, blueberries and things like that, the water spreads germs, and it also removes a naturally protective coating on a berry that would keep it preserved longer. So wait for washing until right before you're going to use the berries.
Well, they need sugar.
Totally.
Otherwise, they're very, very tart. You'll never get your lips open again. But you can use all kinds of flavor additions as well.
Absolutely. And oranges, which are available right now also for little less than what you would find them in the summer months because they're seasonal too. If you use the zest or the juice from an orange, you can make a cranberry orange relish. You can make it with nuts. Oh, and of course, you can add triple sec, which is an orange-flavored liqueur, if you should want to do that. Or chop the entire orange up and kind of cook them basically in the same way. There's a bazillion recipes out there. There are salsas that you can make with cranberries. You can add things like apples to them. You can add things like lemon to them. They're good paired with citrus for a reason, because they're both seasonal, of course.
There's one recipe that I really like around the holidays, and it's like sugar on top of sugar kind of thing, but it starts with a superfood, right? So you take cranberries and simmer them in maple syrup, and then take that out, put them in a colander, let that drain off, and then when they're cool enough, you roll them in sort of a bigger grain sugar.
Oh, nice. Do they separate then, and you can pick them up and eat them one berry at a time?
Yeah.
Oh, for cool.
And they're just a really nice snack. They're really good on a baked brie.
Oh, yes. I can see it all now. Christmas! Except, will you invite me to your house then for Christmas dinner? Because I think
sure.
that you sound like you really know how to spruce this stuff up. However, I just had a thought.
I think you
know?
Could teach me a lot.
So. I don't know. Well, you know that I have to laugh because Germans really like Prunkuchen. And so I've quit calling it Prunkuchen because prunes are actually dried plums. So now it's like dried plum Kuchen. And that seems to be more palatable. So if you're trying to get somebody to try cranberries, you know they dry them and call them craisins.
Right.
And they are delightful on any kind of lettuce salad that you make. I love those things.
I've noticed that marketing trend. I've gone into these big box stores and I'm seeing dried plums now everywhere.
Right. And so I'm like, well, is not an Instant Pot a pressure cooker by any other name? You know, I mean, it's just a marketing ploy, right? Oh, no.
Well, we've talked about cranberries with Root Cellar Sue. Sue, and if you have a question for you, how do we get that question to you?
Oh, go to my website at rootcellars.com, and there's a little contact form down there, and you can ask me questions. We'll be happy to add them to our radio program. And we love talking about food, so yeah, hit us up, baby.
You can go ahead and send a question also to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, and we will get that forwarded to Sue. Sue, thank you.
Oh, thank you, guys. It's always a pleasure.
What's happening is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, announcing their 12th annual special edition ornament this year, one-of-a-kind spearfishing decoys made by Rick Whittier of Lidgerwood, North Dakota. Go to nd.gov/arts or the North Dakota Heritage Center gift shop.
Well, that's the question we ask every Thursday here on Main Street. And joining me to look at the options is Bill Thomas, our director of radio here.
Hi. And well, this time of year, boy, you almost have to do your own research because there is so much happening. All the seasonal performances, there's great music performances and food events and kids putting on shows. And there's so much going on. But I'm going to start at the Chateau des Morts in beautiful Medora. Badlands give you a taste of ethnic Christmas. They are doing this part of the old-fashioned cowboy Christmas thing, and it's a served buffet featuring foods from the Ukraine and Eastern Europe. And this is happening on Saturday from 9 to 5. It's $15 for adults, $5 for children, and will be good taste and fun.
All right. Skate with Santa. You can celebrate the holiday season with a free open skate on Sunday from 2:15 to 4:15 at the Moorhead Sports Center. Visit with Santa and Mrs. Claus. Take a photo and skate to many Christmas favorites. There'll be hot chocolates and cookies, and limited skate rental will be available. Otherwise, it's a free open skate.
And there's a cowboy musician, Greg Hager, and he is playing in a couple of places in North Dakota. Saturdays, December 8th, this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Arts Center in Jamestown, and he's doing a Christmas concert. He's well-recognized as a cowboy performer. And then he's heading out to Williston, and he will be at the Missouri-Yellowstone Confluence Center on Sunday. He will perform at 3 p.m. that day.
The December Bluegrass Jam Session at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City will be held on Saturday from 1 to 5. This is an acoustic-only jam. It's free and open to the public, and beginning and experienced bluegrass musicians are welcome. So take in the December Bluegrass Jam Session at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City on Saturday.
Now, this has nothing to do with Christmas, solstice, Hanukkah, or anything. As a matter of fact, it's the opposite. It's Midsummer Night's Dream. I think putting it on in the middle of the winter in North Dakota is an inspirational idea.
It's a dream.
Yeah, it's a dream. And it starts tonight. It's running through Saturday at NDSU's Askanasia Auditorium. NDSU students get in free. Other adults pay $15, seniors $12. And they are doing a kind of 80s teen movie take on Midsummer Night's Dream.
Leg warmers.
Yeah.
All right. You can join the Bizman Big Band for a free concert at 2 on Sunday at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. It will consist of some of the region's finest musicians and music educators. The Bizman Big Band will host a delightful Sunday afternoon of swinging big band music in the Russell Reed Auditorium, featuring music of the great classic bands, including Henry Mancini, Glenn Miller, and Count Basie. The concert is part of the State Historical Society of North Dakota's Sensational Sundays series.
So one of the things that happens this time of year is the schools, the colleges have their semesters winding up, and a lot of times they have concerts at the end. And at Concordia College in Moorhead, which has an excellent music school, they have a percussion ensemble concert coming up this Saturday at 3. And then on Monday at 7:30, they've got the vocal jazz ensemble concert. And these college concerts are usually really good. I love going to them. So watch out for ones in your vicinity if you're not near these.
All right, I've got a couple of big musical shows that are starting up this weekend. A Christmas Story, the musical, will be at the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater, and it's the rendition of that classic holiday movie favorite, A Christmas Story, the same name, on the stage at Island Park. The theater company presents the musical. This is a beloved holiday tale of Ralphie Parker and his Christmas wish, which I think is a BB gun. So adults, $25, seniors, $20, students, $15. It starts Friday, and it runs through the weekend through the 22nd of December. And also, the Northern Plains Dance puts on the Nutcracker in Bismarck. That opens Friday and runs through Sunday. You can be part of the magic of a classic Christmas tradition as Northern Plains Dance presents that Nutcracker classic at Bismarck's historic Belle Mayhus Auditorium. This is the beloved story of a young girl and her Christmas dream. Is sure to inspire and thrill audiences of all ages, and tickets range from $10 to $32. That's at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium in Bismarck.
Ah, beautiful place to see that. The area choirs all around are putting on their annual concerts, and the FM choral artists are no exception. December 8th on Saturday at 10 a.m. in the community room at the main library, they have a free holiday treat for the whole family, seasonal songs, and children can join in with rhythm instruments. So that'll be a lot of fun. That's 10 a.m. on Saturday, the FM choral artist in Fargo at the library.
The Stutzman County Courthouse State Historic Site will host two holiday open house events on December 9th and 16th from 1 to 5. The rooms of the courthouse will be dressed for the holidays with themed trees decorated by community organizations and businesses. The 1883 Courthouse Committee and courthouse staff will decorate the halls and courtroom. The events are free and open to the public. Hot cocoa and cookies will be served. Incidentally, that courthouse is located at 504 3rd Avenue Southeast in Jamestown.
Who'd think you'd want to go to court for the holidays?
Yeah, well, it's an historic court anyway.
Yeah, right.
What's your pick this week?
Okay, my pick of the week, it's an orchestra concert. The Minot Symphony Orchestra is doing their holiday magic concert in collaboration with the concert choir and the Minot Chamber Chorale on Saturday, December 8th at 7:30 p.m., and that is happening at Ann Nicole Nelson Hall on Minot State, and the ticket prices are, you know, about what you'd expect for this. I won't go into all the details of it, but it will be a fun concert with the Minot Symphony Orchestra.
And my pick is that new documentary film we talked about on our show yesterday, 1898-1899, North Dakota Goes to War. It's the story of the first North Dakota infantry volunteers, men who fought in the Philippines during the Spanish-American War. A lot of them were attending the North Dakota Agricultural College at the time, now NDSU. It's a production of the Fargo History Project. It's scheduled to premiere Monday at 7 at the Fargo Theater. The public is invited. There's no charge for admission. And that's what's happening.
When retiree Chris Kringle gets a job working at Macy's, he unleashes a wave of goodwill through the commercial world of New York City. But seen as deluded and dangerous by Macy's vocational counselor, Chris is admitted to Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital and ends up in court. What is at stake is one little girl's belief in Santa. In a dramatic decision, the court has to determine if Chris is the true Santa Claus. Dakota Stage of Bismarck presents Miracle on 34th Street, November 29th through December 1st, and December 6th through the 9th. More information and tickets are available at dakotastageltd.com or by phone at 701-258-4998.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 6th. Lieutenant Colonel George Custer was based at Fort Abraham Lincoln in Mandan. He rode out of the fort on May 17, 1876, and never returned. On this date in 1907, the Washburn leader printed a letter with memories of the Little Bighorn Massacre. Letter writer Grant Marsh was a riverboat pilot and captain. His exploits on the Upper Missouri and Yellowstone Rivers are legendary. In his letter, Marsh said his memories were triggered by a casual encounter with a man named Courtney, who had a woodyard on the Missouri River. In 1874, Marsh's steamer, Josephine, stopped there to resupply. Marsh asked about a party of Indians who were just leaving. Courtney said they were friendly Crow on their way to visit Obsarecas, a Crow word meaning soldiers. It was the only Crow word Marsh ever remembered, and it would become important. 2 years later, Marsh was the pilot of the Far West, Custer's supply steamer. A small group of men was fishing in the Little Bighorn River about 500 yards from the boat. Suddenly, an Indian rode out of the brush. With a shout of "Indians," every man grabbed his gun. The lone Crow warrior held his rifle over his head, indicating that he meant no harm. When the men recognized him as one of Custer's scouts, they motioned for him to cross the river. He was quite excited. They took him to Captain Baker, who was in military command at the boat. They later learned that the scout was called Curly. Curly could speak no English, and no one on the boat could speak Crow. Curly took a pencil from Marsh's pocket. He drew a circle on the top of a wooden box. He made dots inside the circle. With each dot, he repeated, "Obsarecas." Then he drew a larger circle around the first one. As he made dots in the second circle, he repeated, "Sioux." Captain Baker wondered aloud what "Obsarecas" meant. Marsh was able to say that it meant soldier. It was the entirety of his Crow vocabulary. Baker knew immediately that Custer's force was surrounded and probably soundly defeated. Curly had brought the first word of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, or Greasy Grass. The men in Major Reno's command had also seen action, and the Far West would soon be racing back to Bismarck with more than 50 wounded troopers. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This year is the 100-year anniversary of the end of World War I. One of our Dakota Datebook writers, Jim Davis, had the idea of doing a series that chronicled North Dakota's experience with the Great War. A lot of you told us these were really interesting, so we took all the scripts, put them into a file you can read, and you can download them at prairiepublic.org/radio. North Dakota and the Great War at prairiepublic.org/radio.
Friday on Main Street, the Santa Run in Bismarck helps improve the lives of those facing addiction. This year's run will feature a special guest, Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Craig Mitchell, who started the Midnight Mission Running Club to help people dealing with addiction and homelessness. The club inspired a documentary titled Skid Row Marathon, which will screen tomorrow night in Bismarck. We'll visit with Judge Mitchell and Bismarck Judge David Reich on our show tomorrow. News Director Dave Thompson will join us for our weekly discussion of the headlines, and Matt Olean will review The Front Runner, a dramatization of Gary Hart's run for president in 1988. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.